Should religious institutions be eligible for public funds in some cases, all cases, or no cases? We will examine that question as we discuss this week's U.S. Supreme Court ruling that says a church is entitled to taxpayer dollars to fix a playground. What's your reaction to that ruling? And what's going on with the separation between church and state? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@WPR.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. I'm Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network. We will talk about these issues with Frank Ravitch, professor of law and the Walter H. Storrs Chair in Law and Religion at the Michigan State University College of Law. He recently wrote about this case for the website SCOTUS Blog. Good morning. Thank you very much for being with us.
Well, it's my pleasure.
So this ruling involves Trinity Lutheran Church in Columbia, Missouri. It operates a preschool and a daycare learning center as a part of its church ministry, and it applied for a grant from the state of Missouri to resurface its playground. Apparently the state said, separation of church and state, and the school or the church said, we're going to challenge that, and I guess the Supreme Court sided with the church.
Yeah, basically, Missouri denied the funding under its own state constitution, which has a provision that prohibits any taxpayer funding for religious schools. And after they denied the funding, the church sued. It made its way through the court system, and then ultimately the Supreme Court held that a public benefit can't be denied to a religious entity because it's a religious entity. If that happens, it violates the free exercise clause of the United States Constitution. That's essentially the nutshell of what the court held.
Yeah. Well, so did this surprise you at all?
Given the current makeup of the court, I'll have to say I wasn't completely surprised. The decision itself is much broader than just church playgrounds, and that's really the cause for concern. I think that a lot of us, there was some hope that the court would more clearly draw a line between a program like the one in Missouri and something like a voucher program or something like that. And the court does, there's a footnote where four of the justices in the majority opinion suggested that there might be some boundary like that, but it's just not clear. So the decision could have, very, very broad implications. The subject of the case, just the playground resurfacing, that's not that big a deal. You could see how denying access to a program like that might be problematic. It might not even be necessary under the Missouri constitutional provision, but the reach of this decision is much broader than that.
Yeah, I'm just curious why it might not be problematic for taxpayer dollars to be used for a private religious church to fix up the place.
Well, there's this long line of precedent that unfortunately the court, I think, really distorted in the voucher case several years ago. But the original line of precedent itself suggests that, if you have a program that doesn't have any religious substance at all, that it's really something like a playground resurfacing, something along those lines. The main cases involve disability services that are broadly available under the federal act that protects students with disabilities. And the idea was, look, if somebody needs a sign language interpreter or if someone needs some disability support, there's no reason they couldn't get it within a religious school as well, if they, so long as, it's available at every school. And the idea was that this was sort of a secular service, even though theoretically, it could be, you know, they could be translating, you know, if it's an interpreter translating something religious, it was viewed to be okay. But then the court took it further with, you know, upholding vouchers and things like that. This case, if it wasn't for that voucher case, this case might very easily fall within that other line of cases. Look, it's a safety thing for kids, and, you know, there's no religious content to it, you know, and therefore it would be okay under that older line of precedent. But, of course, that precedent was so distorted in later cases that at this point, you know, this is you could call this a wedge case. You know, this is something that's going to lead to potentially much broader funding for religion. So there is this understanding that it's not an inherent constitutional violation just because some money goes to a religious entity in some way. That was long understood to be okay.
Yeah, the court ruled 7-2 in favor of the church, Trinity Lutheran. Two of the court's more liberal members, Justices Kagan and Breyer, were part of the seven that ruled in favor of Trinity. So this was not a split decision, was it?
No, there was a strong dissent, but you're right. The dissent was only for two justices, Justices Sotomayor and Ginsburg. You know, Breyer only concurred in what's called the judgment. It's a way of concurring and saying, I don't agree with the reasoning of the case, but I agree with the result. And I think he was thinking about that line of cases that I just mentioned. I'm not quite sure where Kagan fell because she didn't write a separate opinion, but I'm wondering, you know, I mentioned that footnote in the opinion that might theoretically limit the scope of the case, and I'm wondering if that footnote was added to keep her in. You never know for sure, but it suggests that possibility. But yeah, it was a 7-2. I find there was a concurring opinion by Justice Gorsuch, which I think I found particularly troubling. But
why did you find it troubling?
Because that opinion refused to. It was for Gorsuch and Thomas, and it refused to join in that footnote that I mentioned. This is footnote 3. I think it's going to become a pretty famous footnote that says that, you know, if something has religious content, you know, we're not deciding whether this holding would apply. And they refused to join into that and suggested that, you know, the implication was very clear that even in something like a voucher program or more direct funding for religious purposes, you couldn't distinguish so long as it was part of a general, and I'm you can't see because it's radio, but I'm putting my fingers up in quotes, public benefit program. You know, that's the way the court explained it.
Yeah, and again,
I mean, there are air quotes here, as I'm saying.
and that footnote, just reiterate, this was Chief Justice Roberts' a footnote which read, "This case involves express discrimination based on religious identity with respect to playground resurfacing. We do not address religious uses of funding or other forms of discrimination."
Exactly. And that is a potential limit on the scope of the opinion. The problem is it was only for four justices, what we call plurality. Although I think that it's pretty clear Justice Breyer, Justice Sotomayor, and Justice Ginsburg would agree with that, even though they weren't part of this opinion directly. But there's other language in the case which suggests otherwise, and it's really hard to know, you know, until future cases whether this is an actual limitation on the scope of the opinion or if it's just a way to maybe get another justice or two in the majority.
Yeah. We have just a minute before news, but a quick reaction to Justice Sonia Sotomayor in her dissent, writing, "This weakens the country's longstanding commitment to a separation of church and state, beneficial to both."
Well, you know, I agree with her that separation is beneficial to both. There's the Jeffersonian model of separation protecting the state from religion, but there's also the sort of the Roger Williams model of protecting religion from the state for separation. And I think she's right about that. Unfortunately, long before this opinion, going back into the 1990s, the court really began eroding the wall, so that even before this opinion, it was more of like a pile of bricks than a really strong wall. So I agree with her completely in that sentiment, and I think it's a shame that the court has moved away from the strong wall.
We are talking about this Supreme Court ruling this week that was in favor of a church looking for taxpayer money to resurface a playground, and we'll continue after we check news. You're listening to the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. We are talking with a guest law professor about the U.S. Supreme Court ruling this week that says a church can receive taxpayer money to resurface a playground. We're talking about the ruling, and we will talk more about the implications of the ruling. What might this mean for the future? Other cases, perhaps, involving church-state issues. How about voucher school issues? 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. So are you in favor of this ruling or not? Are you concerned about what this means or not? Or do you think that this was the right way to go? Our guest is Frank Ravitch, professor of law at the Michigan State University College of Law. He recently wrote about this case for the website SCOTUS blog, and we have posted that on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. We have lots of callers, so let's go to Mike in Seneca. Hi, Mike.
Hello.
Yes, what do you think?
Well, first of all, I do agree with separation of church and state, but I believe for what originally the purpose was intended is to keep any political power or any influence that way from occurring. In this case, I don't see where that would have been a factor, a political influence, and also, to many people's concerns, this was a recycling program. It would have benefited the whole community by being able to do that. So that's my thought. What's your take?
Yeah, that's right. I guess the recycling or the playground resurfacing was going to be tires, and so I guess there was some recycling involved there. So was that part of the public good, Professor Ravitch?
Well, you know, I think the case itself, if the case was just about the tire program, which did involve recycled tires that were being used to resurface, that would be much less troubling. But the problem is that this case, the implications of the case could apply to many things much closer to the core of things like religious education more directly, and other programs. So the problem is that there this is a case that may or may not have breaks on it, depending on how that footnote is read by future courts. So the implication, is pretty broad for this case. I mean, it's not as narrow as just the playground tires themselves.
Neil on Facebook writes, I head up a small church, and I think this is very wrong. Religious schools are for a reason, and that reason is to teach their views. It is wrong for a church-operated school to ask for or receive taxpayer dollars. This from a person who has 16 years of church-based education. Would they have approved it for a Muslim school? Well, clarify for us, Professor Ravitch. Was this a school, a church school, asking for money?
Basically, what it was, the way the program itself worked is this was a church sort of preschool, and they were asking for reimbursement they wanted to use these recycled tires to make the playground safer for the kids, essentially a better surface. And so they were asking for reimbursement for the money they would use to use the recycled tires on the playground surface. So, yeah, they were asking for money. It wasn't in the form of a direct grant to the school, the school's educational program. It was, this program itself was limited just to the playground resurfacing. Of course, the opinion itself is not limited to that.
Yeah. Let's take a call from Greg in La Crosse. Hi, Greg.
Actually, your guest mentions treating churches, this church fairly with other corporations has a broad reach, potential broad reach implications. Specifically, how might this decision impact I think it's the Johnson Rule or the view of the Johnson Rule, where churches may not donate at an unlimited amount or money to political campaigns, but other corporations may.
Can you explain that to us, Professor Ravitch?
Yeah, you know, the Johnson Rule is this part of Section 501c3 of the tax code, and it, what the Johnson Rule says essentially is that churches can't maintain tax-exempt status if they are involved in political, partisan political activity. And I don't think this case would affect the Johnson Rule directly, because while the Johnson Rule only applies to churches, it's part of a tax exemption that only applies. Well, churches are one category of it under a broader rule, but it's a different, the rule set up differently than this sort of program. So I think now there is a separate threat to the Johnson Amendment going on now, and that would be, I think, a huge mistake to get rid of the Johnson Amendment. But I don't think this case will have a big impact on the Johnson Amendment itself. Although I think people should be concerned about that issue as well.
You know, I realize that we maybe didn't finish Neil on Facebook's, implied question. Would the Supreme Court, have ruled the same way if this were a Muslim institution asking for the same thing?
You know, I think that the whole thing would have come down the same way from the beginning. Missouri, I think, would have denied it regardless of the religion involved. The Missouri constitutional provision was pretty clear, and the rule was there before Trinity Lutheran. The rule to deny to religious entities was there before Trinity Lutheran applied for the funding. I do think this is one where it would have applied the same way, although I think that his post on Facebook raises a really, I think, a very important practical question, which, you know, he said that my church would never do that. And there are a lot of religious entities, you know, churches, synagogues, mosques, other religious entities that really don't want to take part in these sorts of programs because they are worried about the implications. They're worried that, you know, it's going to send a message that could erode the Establishment Clause. So I think that the church is still free to not apply for these sorts of things. But I think one of the things is that, particularly if we get to things like vouchers, the ones that are going to apply are going to be, churches that don't have these sorts of theological objections to these funding programs. So, kudos to the minister for that. But, I think that after this opinion, that's a theological choice now. Before, it was possibly a legal mandate. Now it's a choice that churches will make.
Yeah. And again, if the church said, I want money for paying teachers or buying textbooks, that's a different situation than I want money to resurface the playground.
Yes. Now, the problem is that, again, it's that footnote. You read it on air. You know, that footnote is the only thing that stands between this sort of thing, playground resurfacing, and something more direct. Although I will say the court had already upheld many, many years ago in the 1960s the giving of secular textbooks to religious schools. But in terms of other sorts of aid, yeah, I mean, I think that this opinion, it depends on how that footnote's read, and if it's read the way I think it's probably going to end up being read, you're right. I mean, you're exactly right. That's all going to be fair game.
Yeah. So Wisconsin has had a taxpayer-funded school voucher program in place for a couple of decades now, and the U.S. Supreme Court, if I'm not mistaken, did weigh in that it is constitutional. So what is the concern from voucher critics over this ruling?
Yeah, I think this really is the heart of where this case could go. What the Supreme Court held in the case called was a case called Zelman v. Simmons-Harris, and the court, it was an Ohio voucher program, and the court held that the vouchers can be given by the state, even if the vast majority of people end up going to religious schools. Now, I think that was a mistaken decision for a lot of reasons I've written about. But the one thing it didn't say is that you must include religious entities if you start a voucher program. So, for example, in Maine, they have a program because of the way the state is geographically, there aren't public schools everywhere, and they have a program to send children to private schools, but they excluded religious schools. Now, it's very likely they can't do that anymore. So if you set up a voucher program now, it seems that you can't exclude religious entities from that program. And, you know, the way these programs work, the vast majority of money tends to go to one or two religious entities because you've got more subsidized schools with certain churches, tend to be very large evangelical churches or Catholic churches that have the ability to take lower tuition vouchers for students than, say, you know, a smaller Jewish or Muslim or mainline Protestant school that may not have the ability to take a student for that amount of money.
We are talking with Frank Ravitch. He's a professor of law and the chair of the Walter H. Storrs Chair of Law and Religion at Michigan State University College of Law, talking with him about this recent U.S. Supreme Court ruling in favor of a church that was looking for taxpayer money to resurface a playground. Some have worried that this is eroding the wall between church and state. Are you worried about that? What questions do you have? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Frank in Door County is with us. Hi, Frank.
Hi, I'm a Lutheran minister, and I previously served a church that had a 4K preschool program. And when 4K came in, in order to sustain the preschool program, we decided to go with a 4K program from the school district. The people in the congregation saw it as a free feeder for the preschool to keep it sustainable. Otherwise, it would have gone out of business. What happened was the wall was totally demolished. The line was waving all over in the wind. The two became under one board. Money was flowing back and forth between a parochial preschool and a 4K program run by the school district. And there was no differentiation. Capital improvements were paid for by the school district to our facility. And I'm opposed to all this, and eventually this relationship dissolved. I'm opposed to this because I think it threatens the mission of both entities, and so I'd like your comments about this. I mean, it was a mess.
I would like your. I will get our guests' comments. But why do you think that this threatened the mission of both entities?
Well, in the sense that I didn't know at what point I could be a proclaimer of the gospel and not, because, you know, in good conscience, I wouldn't do that while a state-funded school was underway. But at the same time, by virtue of being present and receiving funds, there was just no line there.
I get it. Professor Ravitch?
Yeah, this is, I think, a really fundamental question. You know, everybody tends to view the concept of separation of church and state from the Jeffersonian model, from this idea of Thomas Jefferson's idea of separation, that, you know, you're trying to protect the state from religion. But I think, as the caller points out, you know, there is this other view. Roger Williams is most famous for stating it, but others, you know, de Tocqueville mentioned it when he was talking to people after the Constitution. And the idea is that what Williams said is, look, we need a strong hedge wall between the church and civil society, including government, because, you know, otherwise the civil society will overgrow religion and will corrupt it. And so, you know, there is a very, very strong reason to try to keep government money out of sort of religious programs. It can end up really having the sort of exact sort of effect that that the caller mentioned. I mean, you've got the potential for churches to feel like they have to, you know, change their doctrines. You have the potential for, you know, government regulations that might be perfectly okay for a secular entity, but create significant problems for religious entities. And then the religious entities become reliant on the money, and they have to adapt to these secular regulations in order to keep taking the money. So it affects their religious doctrine. So I think that's a really good example of the other problem with this sort of funding. And it's something that I think is often missed. It's something the court mentioned in school prayer decisions back in the 60s, but we haven't really heard it mentioned much in decisions by the court over the last, you know, 20, 30 years.
Thank you, Minister Frank. Greg in Ripon is with us. Oh, I'm sorry, it's Gary in Ripon. Go ahead, Gary.
Yes, good morning. My question is, now that the church has accepted taxpayer money or public money to resurface their playground, does that mean they are required to allow the public to use the playground?
You know, it's an interesting question. They already were allowing the public to use the playground, not during school hours, but after school hours. The Missouri program, I think, I'd have to go back and check the record in the case to be 100% sure, but my recollection is that the Missouri program that provided this funding would require, at least after hours, that there be access for the public. In this case, it didn't come up in the opinion because the school was already doing that. But it's an interesting question. If you are giving government funds to any sort of religious entity, you know, shouldn't it be open to the public after hours?
We will check news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio, and then we'll continue discussing this this U.S. Supreme Court ruling this week that says a church can receive taxpayer money to resurface a playground. Our guest law professor is discussing the ruling and the implications for the future. And we're welcoming your questions and views at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. You're listening to the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. We are talking about the Supreme Court ruling that says a religious church is entitled to taxpayer money when it comes to the specific request was to resurface a playground. And we are talking about this case and what it means and what it might mean for the separation of church and state. And we're welcoming your questions and your reactions at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@WPR.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Our guest is Frank Ravitch, professor of law and the Walter H. Stowers Chair in Law and Religion at Michigan State University College of Law. He recently wrote about the Trinity Lutheran Church case for the website SCOTUS blog, and we have posted that blog on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. And in essence, and I don't mean to put words in your mouth, Professor Ravitch, but you are looking at this case in a way as a victory for school voucher proponents.
Yeah, I'm very concerned about is, you know, and I should be open and honest. I've been a very big critic of the Zelman case, the case that found school vouchers that predominantly go to religious schools are constitutional. I've long been a critic of that case, but that case said that you may do that. My fear is that Trinity Lutheran is going to now turn that may into a must. So if you have any kind of program that gives vouchers or any kind of tuition assistance to any sort of private school, you're going to now have to include religious schools. And that's, I think, a real concern. The one hope is maybe that footnote 3 will put a limit on that.
Yeah. Why would that be a real concern?
Well, my feeling, you know, it goes back to actually, I think, in a way, the question that was asked about, you know, the harm both to religion and to government that these sorts of programs do. When you have a voucher program, in most places, the voucher amount is going to be a pretty small amount. You know, a lot of private schools spend, you know, a very large amount of money educating each student, just as public schools do. And the voucher amount tends to only work at religious schools that have very large numbers of students or have other sources of funding. And so the vouchers tend to predominantly benefit large faiths and denominations, large, very wealthy churches. And generally, when these programs happen, secular private schools and private schools of smaller religions can't generally take part in the voucher program because they're losing thousands of dollars per student. You know, they may try to take a student or two to help the kids, but for every kid they take, they're losing thousands and thousands of dollars. Whereas for a more subsidized religious school, that's not a problem. And so what ends up happening when you have these programs is frequently you're funneling the vast majority of these kids into sectarian schools. What raises a problem here is, of course, what happens to the kids who aren't able to take part in that? So you've got this, you know, let's say you have a parent whose faith very much opposes the child converting to Catholicism or evangelical Christianity or something. And from that parent's perspective, if that child, you know, obviously goes to a school, whether it's by direct proselytization or by maybe just tons and tons of exposure, there's a significant chance that that child might end up adopting the other religion. So the parent has to choose. Now, do I keep my child in the failing public schools, which is usually why we have these programs in these areas, that are now going to have more money and students sucked out of them by the voucher program, or do I send them to the school where their life in this world will be a lot better, but they may sacrifice their eternal life if the parent believes that? Or a parent who's an atheist or agnostic may feel that their child's going to go down a path that they view as very destructive to their development. And so they have to make these very, very hard choices, all while money is being sucked out of the schools that were already problematic. And this is, I think, the real problem with the voucher programs funding religious entities. And Trinity Lutheran sort of takes away, I think, state and local governments' abilities to say, okay, well, we're going to do a program, but we're not going to include religious schools in that program, or, you know, we're not going to include, you know, we'll set up some sort of program that allows money to subsidize some things within a school, but we're not going to include sectarian elements of the school.
Let's go to Gary in Merrill now. Hi, Gary.
Yes, good morning. See, I am familiar with a school in Coon Rapids, Minnesota. It's a suburb of Minneapolis. It is a Muslim school. They do receive state funding. They have state teachers, but it is a religious school. And I think that in your guest in his state, in Dearborn, Michigan, and Hamtramck, which is mostly Muslim, isn't the federal government pouring millions of dollars into those schools because the Muslims won't go to any school other than a religious Muslim school?
Actually, no. The money that is coming in there, the government funding. There was some sort of rumor out there about this massive amount of government funding going into the Muslim schools in Dearborn and the Hamtramck area. It's just not accurate. I'm not quite sure where that started. There are funds that go to all schools, secular, religious, non-religious, for the help of students with disabilities and things like that. So there are disability services programs and things like that. So it's theoretically possible somebody calculated whatever that amount would be for those schools, and then failed to mention that it applies to every school, public, private, around the country. But yeah, no, that's really not accurate. I can't comment on the school in Minnesota because I'm not familiar with it. But certainly that's not true about the schools in Michigan. And I think it would be before Trinity Lutheran, I think it would be problematic pretty much anywhere. But after Trinity Lutheran, if you're only feeding it to one type of religious school, it would still be unconstitutional. But if you were feeding it to all the religious schools, regardless of religion, it might be okay.
Let's go to Mary in Milwaukee now. Hi, Mary.
Hello. I understand that religious institutions are tax exempt. So if they're going to start receiving public funds for everything, they should no longer be tax exempt.
We have a number of Facebook comments along those lines too.
The thing with religious schools and tax exemption is they're part, it's 501c3, and you're exactly right. The vast majority of religious entities are tax exempt. They're included in with other charitable entities, from soup kitchens to other sorts of schools that are not religious. I think you certainly could have a policy change that if of course you'd need an administration willing to create the policy change and a Congress willing to support that. But the idea would be you could have that if you're going to accept federal tax exemption, you shouldn't accept funds in other ways. I mean, that's theoretically possible to do. States could do it under their state tax codes for state taxes. But it's not part of the code the way it stands now. It's certainly an interesting, it's a creative approach. There is a question, though, whether that would be viewed as denying an otherwise available public benefit to an entity because it's religious. I think if they did it for all charitable entities, including religious entities, it would fly. It would be allowed. But otherwise, I think it would be maybe still violate Trinity Lutheran.
Nick on Facebook says the First Amendment prohibits government support of religion. Giving public money to a church for any reason is supporting religion. However noble the purpose, this is funding religion. There is no end to this ruling. Soon public money will be used to build churches. First, is Nick's accurate in what he says? The First Amendment prohibits government support of religion?
Well, you know, this is where it's hard to be, you know, sort of a specialist in this area, because I always like to be clear. I'm just the messenger, right?
Yeah.
You know, I didn't make the law, but you know, that's really, when you look at the dissenting opinion that Justice Sotomayor wrote, that's really what she's trying to point out. The problem is, it's been a long time since the First Amendment was interpreted that way when it comes to funding, when it comes to government funding. And so, you know, do I agree that that's certainly a reasonable interpretation of the First Amendment? Sure, I absolutely agree with I think it was Nick. But is it the interpretation that the Supreme Court has of the First Amendment? The answer in the funding area would be no. That there is some ability to get funds when the program is neutral, and at least as the court calls it, neutral and generally open to non-religious entities as well. The fear is that it would be discrimination against the religious entities to exclude them from a program that's open to everyone, and that would violate the free exercise clause, which is also part of the First Amendment. I think the good news for people who are concerned about this erosion of the wall of separation, it's predominantly been in the funding area. You know, things like school prayer are still unconstitutional. Creationism in the schools is still unconstitutional. You know, those sorts of things are still unconstitutional. So it's that erosion of it is more in the really in the funding area. But, you know, I guess my answer would be, you have a good, as a matter of first thoughts on the Constitution itself, sure, that is a reasonable interpretation, but that's not the way the case law has played out over the last 30 years.
Yeah. Well, we are pretty much out of time, so we'll leave it there. Thank you very much for being with us.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
Frank Ravitch, Professor of Law and the Walter H. Stowers Chair in Law and Religion at Michigan State University's College of Law. He recently wrote about this case where the U.S. Supreme Court says that a church, Trinity Lutheran Church in Missouri, can receive taxpayer money to resurface a playground. Thanks to our producers this hour, Chris Molina and Michelle Johnson, and thank you for listening. I hope you stay tuned. There's much more to come. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.